On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
We're joined in studio to go through the front pages of this morning's newspapers by Aideen Finnegan, who's a journalist and the host of the How to Pivot podcast, and also by Paul Hosford, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner and 2021 Irish Journalist of the Year. And it was only fitting, Paul, that because we had Aoife in last week, that we had to have you in as sort of the counterbalance and also to stand up for the patriarchy, obviously. So congratulations to you and thank you both for joining us. I will, however, start with Aideen because the papers are obviously sort of fairly full of vaccine-related stuff, and this idea that Stephen Donnelly is now trying to reduce the 5 month gap between the second COVID jab and the first. It kind of sounds very popular, but you know, don't we have to sort of wait for advice from the likes of NIAC before you decide whether to shorten the doses? And a bit of a slippery slope if you start getting politicians trying to claim credit for stuff which may not be scientifically backed up.
Well, I think actually I don't have the quote to hand here, but I'm pretty sure Kingston Mills in the Sunday Independent has said that we need to actually roll with that now, because if we wait with the 5 month gap, we'll be in January before or February before people qualify for that, and at that point we'll probably have been through the worst of the winter surge. So I suppose you could say it's a slippery slope, or we could be, you know, there are scientists out there who are, you know, I think Luke O'Neill is saying we just go with the 3 months, that is an appropriate gap and will ensure. I mean, I think as well, if we don't get these done by December, we are looking at a scary January. Mm. So, I mean, it's so important that and especially if you think about people who had AstraZeneca vaccines, they wane faster. That's what we understand than the other ones. People who had the Janssen jab, which I think it emerged now.
It's elapsed that little bit quicker.
It should have been after a 3 months. That should have been a two-dose vaccine as well. So you have a massive cohort that maybe don't qualify. And if we don't move on that, then perhaps we'll all be looking back at this conversation feeling like fools.
Mm. Paul, you can understand why the minister would want to try and turn it down to 3 months to try and get as many jabs into arms as possible, but it isn't the advice that's there yet.
Yeah, and I think it's quite interesting if you look at the front page of the Sunday Times. You're talking about cutting this waiting time for the booster or the additional dose, but on the page 2 of the Sunday Times you're talking about massive queues at centres. The question is, if you open up the net to more and more people right now, if we just pulled the restrictions tomorrow and said from 3 months on everyone can get it, who would put the doses in arms? We're being told now that centres are at full capacity. People are being turned away from UCD at 10 a.m. in the morning. Who's going to do it? My colleague Niamh Griffin had a story last week that said that once a lot of these staff were laid off from vaccination centres, that they haven't been rehired because they can't be. They've gone on to other jobs. We don't have the bodies to do it. So the question isn't really about waiting times. I think it's generally accepted that 3 months on, anywhere from 3 months on, you can do it.
The question is, capacity issue.
Will you be able?
Well, on which note then, because I don't know whether yourselves are a bit like me, where you're flooded with people saying that my parents are in their 60s and they haven't been called for a third dose yet. They can't get in the door at any of the top-up centres, and they don't know how you're supposed to make an appointment. They go to the GP and the GP can't help them. The pharmacist can't help them. None of them have any slots. And you wonder how it came to be organised in what looks like such a ropey way compared to the rollout of the first two doses.
Yeah, and I think that that's one thing that comes back to me all the time. People text me all the time, say, how are we in the situation now where this looks bad, when over the summer it ran like clockwork? But then you look at, say, the Taoiseach during the week, during Leader's Question, said that there was about 120,000 no-shows. But when you actually drill down into that, what we found out was that the HSE is actually booking a lot of people in for double appointments. My wife got a text from the HSE saying, you've been flagged as immunocompromised. Show up at City West on this day for your booster jab. Showed up at City West. There was a massive queue. Guy came out and said, oh, if you were flagged as immunocompromised, but you're before your 5 months, it was a mistake. Go home. She'd been there about an hour, went home, tried to get off.
So she was sent that text within the 5 months of the second dose?
Yeah, and then got a text. That was the Saturday. Got a text on the Monday from the HSE saying, you no-showed for your appointment. Please don't do this. You've got another appointment on Friday. So she had to make contact with the HSE and say, I was told to go home. Yeah. What's the story? HSE didn't know. Her GP didn't know. So she didn't go because she's inside the 5 months. Got another text from the HSE saying, you no-showed for your appointment.
Aideen, I can't really understand why they wouldn't have just done the same as previous times. I know that they obviously have a database of everyone, so they know when they got their second dose, so they ought to be able to prioritise people with some sense of structure. But instead of just opening the doors to everyone and then being flooded, and also then the Taoiseach still complaining that there's a lack of enthusiasm, why not just do what they did last time around? Have the online portal, register, get your text, show up all in order. Yeah, it did, more centrally managed.
It did seem to work very well, didn't it? And on the question of capacity, I mean, there are calls now that we train up the army to start this process as well. Like,
everyone loves deploying the army.
They do, the last
army
line of defence.
Yeah, famed crowd controllers and famed medics and famed flood relievers. Isn't there nothing they can't do?
But it is kind of baffling when you think that they did demonstrate at one point that they can move heaven and earth to get these systems in place and get everything rolling. And it does feel a bit stop-starty here now, like they're not quite sure how they're going to proceed.
I think if you've ever been to I'm going to kind of go off on a tangent here.
No, please do.
If you've ever been to a sporting event in the US, they essentially ID for everyone who goes to the bar. So they'll put a sign on the bar that says, to purchase alcohol, your birth date has to be after, and they'll put exactly 21 years from today's date. We all know when we got our last dose of this vaccine, we know what 5 months or 3 months is from that, or 90 days or 180 days. Surely it's just a case of, you know, the system picking up that you are exactly 5 months today, so you're getting your vaccine on X date. So if mine was the 12th of June, I'll get it today. You
12th
know?
Of November or whatever, yeah. But isn't there an issue, though, that if we're not doing the same capacity now as we were in summertime, that in summertime, when it was at peak capacity, they were doing 250,000, 300,000, at one point even 350,000 doses a week. So they'd have to match that pace again this time around, which they just can't do because they don't have the same number of vaccination centres, because, as you say, a lot of the staff are now back doing other things. So there's always going to be a bit of a lag there.
Yeah, and that's something that the government and the HSE should come out and just say up front, we cannot do it at the same pace. You know, this idea that there's a lack of enthusiasm, or that it's somehow on the public, I don't think bears weight, because you're seeing people being turned away from trying to get it. I mean, how can you say there's no enthusiasm for the additional jab? And of course there's not the enthusiasm, because one, in the summer we were still largely locked down, there was still a lot of things closed, so we all thought getting the vaccine will,
this is our ticket to freedom, or whatever,
exactly. And then the other thing is it's almost Christmas, people have things on, you know, if you get to this weekend and you haven't got your dose or your additional dose, and your options are spend 3 or 4 hours in a queue at City West or UCD, or go and do the last year Christmas shopping, it's a no-brainer.
Or if you're our age and you just think you're not eligible at all, then you wonder what you're supposed to do for Christmas. Aideen, the one thing that strikes me about the rollout of the third dose is that, again, even we're calling it the third dose and other people call it the booster, but that it never seems to have been really communicated by the government or by NPHET or anyone else. I don't even want to go there about whether NPHET have the access to the airwaves anymore. But it's never kind of been explained that the third dose is now kind of more, it gets less optional. It's not this sort of opt-in top-up, that it's actually now kind of presumed to be part of the medicine, and that two doses just doesn't do the job the same as three doses does.
Yeah, and I think that the communication just was so very clear around this, and everyone was very tuned into it, because people were like foaming at the mouth to get their second jab. And now we have that situation again where people are, yes, you know, give me the booster, I'm ready. But I think, I don't know where, how it has fallen between two stools here. There is a lot of miscommunication or misunderstanding around, how do I get it? When do I get it? How am I eligible? I got it in a GP, you know, because my GP rang up and offered it to me, you know, because I have asthma. You know, there's a lot of people going, well, if I got it from the GP last time, will I get it this time? And, you know, I just think there's a huge amount of uncertainty that it hasn't really been nailed down. The communications policy around it isn't very clear. And perhaps it's because everyone's looking the other way at who leaked this information. You know what I mean? Like this great big find the leaker instead of actually what is the job at hand.
In a government that has 35 ministers and 60 special advisors, we must assume that it was the medics that leaked the advice. A texter says to 53106, with respect, the same staff facing sorting all this out are trying to manage the severe difficulties across the health service, which is an absolutely fair point. Someone else says, and I wonder what you, Paul, think about this, if the booster rollout is clearly an omni-shambles, where's the accountability for Stephen Donnelly?
Yeah, look, that's a fair question. And I suppose if I was the minister and I wanted to get this off my desk as soon as possible, I'd probably cut the waiting time as well. But I personally just don't see what cutting the waiting time will actually do if you're not resourcing it, or if you're not back at that capacity. If you're doing, you know, the Taoiseach said that there was, you know, 80 or 90,000 showed up in those last 2 weeks in November. You know, like you said, we were at 350,000. So the capacity is less than a third of where it was. And we have the Taoiseach lecturing people on enthusiasm.
Stay with us, because there are some other interesting stories in the papers, including that one on the front page of the Business Post about a possible review into the contract behind the National Broadband Plan. We'll be talking to the journalist behind that when we're back after this. Let's go back to the other story on the front page of the Sunday Independent this morning. This is about the cabinet being warned about massive job losses whenever the employee wage subsidy scheme is withdrawn. A memo that's saying that nearly 25,000 businesses are dependent on state subsidies and nearly 300,000 jobs are dependent on them, mostly in hospitality. And Aidan Finnegan, when you remember that it's mostly hospitality and hospitality is having such a miserable time of it and so many outlets are going to be closing their doors again for Christmas, and if they're going to survive, it's going to be on these payments and almost these payments alone. And then looking down the barrel of losing that many jobs, it's frightening, isn't it?
It is frightening. And what I find, you know, really, I suppose Hugh O'Connell has written in the Sunday Independent about how he's quoting Eddie Casey, the chief economist of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, that a difficult conversation is going to have to be had in the coming months, because there's this idea that there are zombie businesses and that they're being kept afloat when they would go to the wall anyway. Yeah. And is that money well spent, and should it be put into something else? Mm. And that there's going to have to be a difficult conversation in the coming months, and it's an unavoidable one, about which businesses to continue to support and which businesses need to let go, and how to use the money in better ways to grow a new business. That is a political landmine on the horizon. And obviously these are, you know, figures, but there are real people behind all of these figures and livelihoods. And we are looking at the spectre of what's going to be beyond this fourth wave in terms of the economy, hospitality, the nightclub sector, which obviously has been massively curtailed now.
Paul, it strikes me that it's even more politically damaging when you think about how much play the government makes about how quickly the economy has rebounded. Now there's more people at work than ever before, and the unemployment rate might still be high, but that there are, broadly speaking, jobs for a lot of people. Like, those jobs disappear if you're suddenly going to be laying off hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, and the Taoiseach has made a virtue of this fact, that the fact that the Irish economy has rebounded so quickly, quicker than anyone could have anticipated. But it's pointed out in Hugh O'Connell's the analysis piece inside the Sunday Independent today, that a lot of that is state-backed, that a lot of that is because we've kept people in work. I think completely defensively to keep businesses open. Mm. But I think one of the things that's interesting is if you look at a lot of the businesses that are still supported by EWIS, they're staff who were previously on the PUP. So they were in work, say, February 2020. Mm. You know, the business probably was viable. It was ticking along nicely. Pandemic hits. Staff get let go because hospitality is closed. They come back in July or August last year.
Mm. Hospitality is still working under constrained circumstances. They can't trade fully. They need a bit of help to keep them on books. Yeah,
they get laid off again after Christmas. They go back onto the PUP. They come back this summer. They're being supported by EWIS. So if in March or April we have this, and it has been warmed, this tsunami of insolvencies, if we have thousands of businesses go to the wall next spring, then those people who have been through 2 years of complete uncertainty on and off the PUP, supported by EWIS, probably taking pay cuts along the way.
Yeah,
those people have already had a really tough 2 years. It's going to be really, really difficult for the government to decide who bears that pain and how much of the pain that they actually bear.
There is one really interesting quote in that, which is from Ed Brophy, who's appeared in this programme before. He's a former special advisor to Pascal Donoghue, and he says that there was an expectation in the Department of Finance that EWIS, this employee wage subsidy scheme, would only be needed until around the end of this year and not into 2022. And he again says, I think at some stage next year that conversation will be unavoidable on what businesses we can continue to support and what businesses we need to let go. So basically acknowledging that there is going to be some conscious decision at some point that the state can't keep helping some people.
Yeah, and in fairness, a lot of government ministers have been open about the fact that not every business will survive this, that it has been an unprecedented shock, a kind of once in a lifetime shock to the economy, the likes of which we haven't seen in 10 years. We're part of that generation that's lucky enough to have had two once in a lifetime shocks in the last decade. There will be a conversation had about how we handle this, and it's going to be really, really tricky, because if you're a Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil backbencher in a constituency that relies on tourism, and the Minister for Finance decides to turn off the tap towards tourism-backed industries or hospitality-backed industries at a time when, you know, your area can least afford it, then, you know, it's going to be a difficult talk politically, but societally it's going to be really, really, you know, we can't really bear 300,000 people all of a sudden ending up on the live register.
You can't, but at the same time, Aideen, I suppose the cost of not having those people on the live register is fairly steep as well, because the piece in the Sunday Independent makes it pretty clear that they're talking about, you know, over 5.5 billion euro has been spent on the eWIS scheme so far. Nearly 9 billion euro has been spent on the PUP, which is something no one could have budgeted for this time 2 years ago. And if you don't want 300,000 people to be laid off sometime next spring, you're going to have to keep spending at a rate that no one ever really anticipated and which we're not really raising the taxes for.
Yeah, and those figures, those eye-watering figures, we haven't heard from, you know, probably since the first shock in the last 10 years that Paul was mentioning there.
The first of those two-in-a-lifetime things, yeah.
Exactly. And I think, I don't know, but I'm speculating that perhaps, that, you know, we learned back then that we actually, austerity didn't work, and, you know, that perhaps you just have to spend and spend and spend your way out of this. But I think the problem is that every time we think we have this, we have a lid on it, that, you know, something comes along and we have the threat of restrictions looming large again, and that's going to require the checkbook to be opened.
I think just to make a point that came up kind of during the week, if you look at what happened with the eWIS this week, the government was warned all throughout November, hospitality sector kind of saw which way the direction of travel was going. They saw that there was more restrictions coming. They begged the government not to cut the eWIS.
We should have said that before now in this conversation. The government cut the rates on December the 1st, and the hospitality sector were saying, lads, we can't survive without that. And we spoke to the Hotels Federation last week about it.
And then reinstated it on Thursday. And I suppose one of the question that I asked Pascal Donoghue at that press briefing was none of this gamed out? You know, I fully accept that this virus is unpredictable, that sometimes we think we've got it going one way and it goes another way. But surely at a certain point, you have to play the scenarios and say, what would happen if we wanted to do this? So the government's plan when they cut the eWIS was to bring in a targeted version of the COVID restriction support scheme, the CRIS. Pascal Donoghue said on Thursday, 8 days after the eWIS had been cut, that a targeted CRIS was too complex. It was too complicated, wouldn't have been in place before Christmas. And you asked that question, was that not thought about on the 1st of November?
No one ever seems to look around any corners to see what might be coming.
And this comes back to the booster campaign. We talked about boosters in July and here we are in December working out what we're doing with them. And eWIS, we're talking about, you know, the rates being reversed and then put back in place.
I do remember talking to Pascal Donoghue at one of the press conferences in springtime of 2020 when all these supports were lined out. And I remember the point being made to him that, are you not going to result in a load of zombie firms here now? You're giving loads of subsidies or you're giving tax holidays or warehousing stuff to businesses who then, when it comes to those bills falling due, just will be stuck and won't have the money. And he said, that is a risk, but we would rather take the risk of keeping companies alive for a couple of years and then having them die than allow them to go off the cliff now. But I suppose what that does remind you is that not only is there all the money that's been spent on PUP and on eWIS, but there's also loads of tax bills that have been shelved for now that we may never get back.
Yeah, that warehousing is, you know, the question is what happens when those bills become due? Do you just write them off? You know, in some cases, there probably will be a write-off for businesses that are under a certain threshold. There's, you know, that's probably what, at this point, it's probably about 1.5 billion, maybe more, warehoused by small firms. They're not going to be able to pay that if the bill all of a sudden becomes due next year. And that's probably more money that you have to write off.
Yeah, that's why there's no money for HEPA filters, but there's money for electricity discounts for everyone, which we might talk about in the next part. Still lots more to come with Paul and Aideen. Don't go away. Paul Hosford and Aideen Finnegan still with me. Paul, the opinion polls today, there's two of them, one in the Sunday Times and one in the Mail on Sunday. Both, again, pretty good looking for Sinn Féin.
Yeah, and I suppose the latest in a long line of good polls for Sinn Féin. The question for Sinn Féin isn't can they poll well. The question is can they turn those good polls into seats. You know, I think one of the things that we lose in these conversations about how Sinn Féin are polling or how the other parties are polling is that we're so used to almost a two party system where a majority or close to a majority in the Dáil is possible. With three medium sized parties, that becomes really, really difficult. You know, at the moment, if you look at Twitter or you look at what some people believe, they would have you believe that Sinn Féin is nearly in a majority in the Dáil as is. They're not even halfway. So for Sinn Féin, the question is, can you turn 34% in a Sunday Times poll in November, 3.5 years before an election, into 60, 65 seats? That would probably be the cap of where most people would see them getting.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really interesting to me in the Sunday Times poll is that Fianna Fáil has edged ahead of Fine Gael. Fine Gael, if you think back to last summer, Fine Gael was polling up around 40% in some in some polls.
There's a real wrap around the flag pandemic bounce, which is completely gone out altogether.
It's completely dissipated. They feel stuck in the mud. A lot of people that I talked to in the party say that, you know, polls are a snapshot in time. They only really capture the public mood. We're still a long way out from an election. But I suppose the counter to that and what a growing number of people in the party say is that this is a trend of really bad polling. It's a trend where they haven't been above 30% probably for the last 6 months. But also, they had a bad election last time around as well. So it's not like they're, you know, they're game day players who have been training really badly in midweek, like Paul McGrath, and turned it on a Saturday. Like the last time they went out to play, they played pretty poorly. So for them, look, there's no questions about leadership or about anything like that just yet. But there is questions about what they can do to reverse that trend.
That's such a good analogy, the Paul McGrath one. That's brilliant. What was particularly struck by for the Mail on Sunday poll was that they were also asked, people who said they were going to vote for Sinn Féin, what was the most important factor in determining your vote for them? 1% said it was because they like Mary Lou. 2% it was because they were effective locally. 6% says it was because they want a united Ireland. 25% said it was because of the spokespeople. 49% of people said they just wanted to vote for change.
Yeah, and that's
which maybe suggests that there's a vulnerability there, that if the government was suddenly make people feel like they weren't doing too badly, that they could make some inroads again.
Yeah, and I suppose you could look at it that way. But the other thing is that you could look at it and say that the brands of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are just tired. If you look at where Labour was at in 2016, the brand was bad, so it didn't really matter how good or effective the local TD was. They got a walloping anyway. For Sinn Féin, we look at how strong the brand was and how strong that vote left, transfer left movement was at the last election, where, you know, Patricia Ryan got elected having gone on holiday. People who hadn't got council
seats,
people
who lost their council seats a few months previously,
were nowhere near council seats. We're topping polls in a general. You know, a lot of it can be to do with branding, but then there is that dissatisfaction with, I suppose, the way the last couple of months have gone. I think a lot of it, if you're being generous to the government, a lot of it is just pandemic fatigue. People are really, really tired. I don't think anyone wants an election right now, least of all Paul Carr's. I think I speak for you
myself,
definitely.
You absolutely do.
And some of the gallery. You know, I think people want a couple of months of normality, and I think the government would probably benefit from that. It's going to be very hard to reverse a poor polling trend or a want for change when what people actually want to change is the entire world around them, because they don't want to live under restrictions anymore.
My producer, who by the way shares your football club affiliations, is delighted that you got to mention Aston Villa legend Paul McGrath in that. Mick is delighted now, peering through the glass. Before we finish, 18, there's one fascinating piece in today's Sunday Times about Ireland's most popular podcast this year, and it's not The Two Johnnies, it's not Highlights from On the Record with Gavin Riley, although it really ought to be, or plenty of the other fabulous News Talker Go Loud podcasts. It's not How to Pivot, your own excellent work. It's Joe Rogan,
yeah.
The man who people Joe know, as mostly know, as being the guy who does the in-cage interviews at UFC.
Yes. I'm going to try and be as diplomatic here, but as possible. But I mean, when you're talking about a guy who does those interviews, hosting a podcast, you can probably draw a conclusion as to the quality of...
Well, for people who don't even know what Joe Rogan's podcast is like, they might get the idea, okay, right, if you're a UFC in-cage interviewer, there's always going to be a certain amount of there. Joe Rogan is a bit more eclectic maybe than most when it comes to people who have on the podcast.
Yeah, so, you know, he's basically somebody who says he's not anti-vax, but he's kind of encouraging people not to get vaccinated and to use ivermectin, which is the veterinary medicine here that has, you know, and it has caused a lot of deaths in the US.
Yeah.
So, I mean, from my point of view, like, he's just somebody who's really irresponsible with a microphone. I think why people love him is just one of the things here it says in the Sunday Times is that there's a full-on bromance with the men who listen to him. One of his interviews with Elon Musk, the Tesla co-founder, conducted while they shared a cannabis joint, has been viewed more than 24 million times on YouTube. And I kind of, it's
so
kind
of... Is that what we need to do then for the next day in the Loris?
apparently, because as the way I see it is just, this is people who don't like the mainstream media. They call them the lamestream media. So instead, they'd rather go and listen to a podcast podcast that's up to 5 hours long with just one guy. I don't understand it myself, but I do understand that.
But is there something to be said though there that if his is the most popular podcast in Ireland and it's discussing topics which, in fairness, studios like this with guests like yourself that we don't usually touch on, we're not going to talk about probably the relative merits of ivermectin, that there's an audience out there that the rest of us just aren't tapping into?
Yeah, but it's because we've kind of come to, the media is regulated here in Ireland, right? The broadcast media is regulated and you have to put both sides. And, you know, I think what most people who listen to the Joe Rogan podcast is that they think me, you and Paul are shills for the government and we're just spouting like the officialdom line, whereas he's getting to the nub of it. When actually he's not really doing any of it. He's just firing out all these questions and going, oh, no, no, I'm not saying anything but. Mm. And the thing is about its conspiracy theories and why people, you know, go along with them is that it offers a simple explanation for a very complex topic. And apparently the way the world has gone with social media, it is all about outrage and grandstanding and, you know, opinions as opposed to careful, curated, nuanced conversations.
Texter 53106 says, say what you like about Joe Rogan, but if it wasn't for him, I would never have found out that the world is flat. In the interest of broadcasting balance, Paul, do you want to take 20 seconds to say anything kind about Joe Rogan?
Yeah, look, I think what he does is he particularly positions himself as a voice for disaffected young white men, has interesting guests on. A lot of the time, some of the people he talks to are experts in their field, but a lot of the people he gives platforms to say irresponsible things, and then he kind of puts the hands up and says, look, I'm not saying it, I'm not an expert. I think Aideen probably hit on it. He sells a very simplistic view of the world at times, or a view of the world that says that whatever is wrong with your life isn't your fault.
Please don't tune into him for the next hour though, because we've got loads more to come up. Aideen, Paul, thank you both very much for joining us.
On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.